Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And we're talking with Kevin Healy, Vice President of Human Resources at St. Mary's Healthcare System in Lewiston, Maine. Kevin, thanks for being on the show.
Oh, you're welcome.
So, you know, healthcare is in full transition right now with a lot of the changes that are going on. Could you present to us exactly what you're seeing in the industry today, especially with everything that's happening?
Sure. I'll take a crack at that. It's pretty volatile, I guess would be the way to describe it. From a HR perspective, when I think about the challenges we're facing, a lot of it goes back to finding the right skill sets. One of the things that we struggle with daily is having the right people with the right skill sets and trying to fill those hot jobs. And we have a lot of them, David. There's kind of a shortage, if you will, of people who have big, long names, polysonographers, x-ray technicians, and all kinds of mid-level providers. So finding those jobs in a very competitive environment is difficult at best. And at the same time that we're trying to find the right skill sets, there are people who are more traditional workers, clerical folks, administrative people, folks like that, that are perhaps not seeing their skills improve or upgrade, and as technology improves, it's tough for them to keep up. So we have some that are being downgraded, or we don't need as much of those types of skills without an upgrade, and there are others that we just can't seem to get enough of. So it's very volatile.
Well, you made the statement a few seconds ago that technology is now playing a big role, and certainly anybody that's gone to the doctor or to a hospital for any reason whatsoever would tell you that technology is now a big part of it. Is part of the challenge the fact that they just don't know those skills, or they are not easily adaptable to those skills? Or what is the real challenge with the technology piece of it?
Well, I think it's multifaceted. First of all, there are many people who are working in healthcare that have been there for a long time, especially in Maine. We're one of the top three oldest populations in the country. So when you look at the typical worker in healthcare, more often than not, you're going to find someone who's been there a long time. So we have long service people, and when you do the same job for many years, I think it's easy for people to let their skills, especially the technology skills, fade away, or at least not, you know, get them up to where they need to be. Rusty's probably the wrong term because new stuff comes in all the time. But unless you're conscientious about upgrading your skills and trying to stay on top of the newest technology, and if you're counting on the employer to do all of that, you know, to send you to training and supply you the new software, which we do, but you've got to take a little bit of an effort on your part to do it as well, you're going to fall behind. And so that's one piece of it when I say it's multifaceted. The other is you may have somebody who is very comfortable and very reliable and knows all the latest things, but things are changing so rapidly that even those folks with the current set of skills can see those fly out the window in a year or two as new technology comes in. So, you know, some of the older folks who haven't done a good job of keeping up, and even those people who have kept up can see things change overnight. One example of that would be electronic medical records. You know, that is a really big push as far as improving the ability of your doctor and the ability of the healthcare organization to track your needs, to know who you are, and to do a better job of providing the services. Well, electronic medical records come in all kinds of forms. So if you're working in a health system out of state and you come to Maine, you may apply for a job here and find that the records that we're using are totally different than where you came from in Virginia or Texas or wherever. So it's not the same everywhere. It's not universal, and people haven't kept their skills up the way that they should. And even if you had, it changes overnight. So good luck with that, huh?
Yeah, no, it really is a challenge in terms of the differences that are out there, and certainly an understanding by, you know, someone that's coming into state or maybe even leaving state and saying, oh, I have this great skill, and only to find out that they don't use, for example, Epic or one of the big healthcare systems.
Exactly.
May not be using one of those type of all-encompassing medical record system. So it is a challenge. There's no question about it. And, you know, the employee who is trying to stay ahead of the curve may think they are ahead of the curve, only to find out that they don't actually know exactly this system coming into.
Yep. I would agree. And the way that you, as an employee, I think are best able to deal with it is to stay informed. There is, you know, a tendency on people, you know, when they're off for the day, they're off for the day. Well, I make an effort to read the journals, you know, check with my colleagues, make sure that I know what's going on, because things change so rapidly that, you know, I want some early warning on what the changes are. And I think healthcare employees in general would be well advised to do that. Otherwise, it's easy to get lulled into "I'm fine," only to find out later that all of a sudden your skills are rusty.
When we're talking about healthcare, there's certainly been a lot of consolidation in the industry, you know, larger systems, and this is a nationwide trend, certainly not just here in the local Maine area. Are you seeing that being helpful in terms of finding talent, or are you finding that actually is a hindrance?
Great question.
Are you a lawyer by any chance? I'm just curious.
No,
you know, whenever we have lawyers on, they always go, well, could be.
But I guess I could be. But the answer really is both. When you look at the various circumstances, consolidation can be helpful in some cases, because when you think about the workforce, I just said, it's difficult to find all the trained techs and all the, you know, the skill sets that we need. And let's just use radiology as an example. If you consolidate radiology services and you're able then to be focused on a central location in a community, and you're not necessarily dispersing and, you know, diluting the available talent, then that's helpful. At the same time, the service that you may offer could be diminished because, well, let's just look at Maine as a rural state. We have a lot of small healthcare centers around the state, and then, you know, the larger cities have a hospital or two. And if those smaller facilities don't have the capabilities to provide service immediately, then I think, you know, it's a diminishment. Even though it may take more to staff those areas, it takes more talent and skills to staff those areas, you at least then have those skills out where they're needed when an emergency happens. So it's a two-edged sword. Consolidation will help us in some ways find talent, focus it where it needs to be. But by focusing it where it needs to be, when something happens elsewhere, you're not as equipped to handle it.
What are you seeing coming out of the universities across the country? You know, we have certainly new physician or, you know, new providers that are coming out into the industry, and they're saddled with, let's be honest, some serious debt coming out of medical school.
Yes.
They're dealing with not only the loans, but you're dealing with some insurance costs that are huge from a liability perspective. And they're certainly looking at hospitals, healthcare systems, maybe even their own practice. How does that factor into being able to find great talent, especially in maybe in the doctor levels?
Yeah, it is a different world than it was just 10 years ago. It wasn't that long ago, David, when a doctor would pretty much hang out their shingle, you know, to use the old terms. They'd have their own office, they'd be independent, they'd hire staff, and they would go into practice. Boy, in 10 years' time, there aren't that many physicians who are now independent. There's been a tendency, a huge shift, for physicians to become employed by hospitals, by healthcare centers, by medical groups, you know, by a larger entity. So the independent physician is rare and getting rarer. So when I go back to your question of, you know, coming out of the universities, what are the new physicians facing? Well, they are facing debt and huge amounts, hundreds of thousands of dollars sometimes, and they are not necessarily going into business for themselves or working for a single physician practice. They're going to work for, you know, a large entity like a hospital or a healthcare center. And on the good side, that provides some stability. On the bad side, it becomes a very competitive situation where you're paid a salary as opposed to setting up your own practice and working 6 days a week, 14 hours a day if you have to get as many patients through to help pay down your debt. You know, those days are pretty much gone. So what happens is a lot of the physicians do end up with a tremendous amount of student debt. And that then impacts where they practice or where they tend to look for a job. When you think about Maine as a rural state, we have, I think, a disadvantage in competing for the new grads, the new talent, with a metro area. Generally, you know, it's a higher cost of living, but also quite a bit better pay when you work in a Boston or a New York or a D.C. than if you were to work in Lewiston or Portland or Bangor. So we have a disadvantage competing for that talent because they carry a heavy debt load, and they're looking to pay that down, just like any normal person would. So we've got to do even more to get them to come here. And we're not alone in that. Most rural states are in the same situation. So the world has changed. We are now seeing them mostly work for larger employers, and then you compete as a large employer with not just other folks across town, but across the country for that talent. It's a difficult challenge, but so far we've been able to do it because we have targeted our recruitment efforts towards people who, how would I put this, are in love with the L.L. Bean image of Maine and, you know, love the outdoors and love the mountains. So, you know, the other advantage we have for these younger positions and mid-level providers coming in is that life is, you know, a balance for them, and they want to balance their life and enjoy the outdoors. So we have an advantage there that offsets some of the financial disadvantage we're at when we're recruiting against major metro areas.
You know, you're talking about hiring and certainly finding the necessary talent that's out there. And this can be more even on a national question. What really can HR professionals in the medical world really do to effectively recruit that necessary talent that's out there? I mean, what are some of the things that you would say are top things that they need to look at? I'm not talking geographically. I'm talking, you know, in what they really need to look at to bring talent to their facility.
You know, the thing I've learned after, gosh, almost three decades doing human resource work is that there's, regardless of your profession or the industry you're in, that most people that you're trying to recruit, of course, are always interested in compensation and, you know, is it a good school system and so forth for your family, but really what it comes down to is they're interested in the culture of your organization. Can I be happy there? Will I feel like I belong? Do I fit in? You know, is it possible for me to develop relationships with coworkers and fellow physicians and, you know, really feel like I'm making a difference, part of the organization? And all of that comes back to culture, you know, and how you manage your day-to-day business and how you treat your people. And, you know, really that's what it comes down to. And I think it's almost universal, maybe even more important for the, you know, the hard-to-get hot jobs and skill sets, because they can go anywhere. So they're less likely to tolerate, you know, just an okay environment. You know, they're looking for the best fit, the best chemistry, the best culture that they can get. And I think that's universal. So your question is, what can HR do? I think HR has tremendous influence on being able to showcase, explain, and make it known what the culture is, and to highlight, you know, the good things that are happening within your organization when it comes to recruiting. You take it outside of recruiting, HR has a tremendous opportunity to influence how that culture is sustained. You know, when employees get in trouble, when they need special consideration, when people communicate and talk to each other. I mean, the role that HR plays in that is, you know, a catalytic role that can make a real difference.
No, you're absolutely right. And actually, you know, that answer talks to all HR professionals in any profession, to be honest with you. It's not just the healthcare world. I mean, culture is absolutely essential today, and probably one of the things that, you know, we talk about certainly on the recruiting side of the business from a recruiter's perspective, that's probably the first thing is the fit, right? The key fit that you're going to have with an organization. And so, you know, skills, yes, check the box. They have them, they can do them, but can they integrate with this organization, and can they fit, and can they, you know, create, enhance, I should say, not more create, but enhance that environment and fit in with the culture that's there. You're absolutely correct on that. You're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates, and we're talking with Kevin Healy. You know, one of the things that it's interesting, and I know you have a case study that you'd like to talk about, and I think that people will be very interested in knowing that sometimes the recession and sometimes the economy or macro things affect what we think will happen in an industry, what we think will happen from a hiring perspective. And so I'm going to let you fill in the blanks here, but that was kind of like a little teaser to say what you're going to be doing today.
Sure. Well, I can give you a pretty good example of what you're referring to. When when I think about HR and trying to be proactive and forecast and project what's likely to happen, we often feel like we have some certainty out a year, 2 years, 3 years, and then it gets grayer the farther out you get, of course. None of us have crystal balls, but we think because of our experience and looking at various metrics and indicators, you know, we can do a pretty good job of forecasting what's going to happen over the next couple of years when it comes to workforce management, workforce development. But I'm giving you an example of how that doesn't always work out, and you always have to have a plan B. We looked at the demographics of our nursing workforce not that long ago, 2005-2006 range, and the thing that we found was that our nursing workforce was similar to the population in Maine, and that it was getting older, one of the older workforces in the country. And the assumption, because nursing can be a very satisfying but also a physically demanding job and an emotionally demanding job, that as nurses reached a certain age, they were going to start retiring. And it caused a bit of a panic, because when we looked at the pipeline of new students and new people coming into the profession, we're concerned that we would see, if demographics can be used as an indicator or a metric for forecasting, we're going to see a huge drop-off of current nurses and not enough coming in to take care of the patients that need them. So one of the things that we really did well as a state, we worked with the community college systems and with the state government, and were able to find ways to encourage more students to come into the nursing field, and we saw that happen in the middle of this decade. And then the recession happened. No one forecast what was going to happen in late 2008, and unfortunately, you know, the results were that many nurses who were thinking about retiring stayed. Some had spouses who lost their jobs, and they came back into the workforce. So we didn't have that turnover that we thought we would have. And unfortunately, we had a lot of new grad nurses who were looking for jobs that were not as available. And now the problem is that as we slowly get back onto the economic track and those nurses start retiring, new grads have stopped going into the programs again because there weren't as many jobs available. So it really, you know, sometimes requires you to think through and have a plan B, as well as you can forecast and as well as it seems logically that these things are going to happen. Life happens while you're planning, and you have to have another plan.
Well, I think that's always some of the challenges that outside factors make, or, you know, or business make in terms of what going on in their business, that, you know, great plans, but you have to have plan B, I guess, is the best answer. Always have a plan B. You know, you mentioned a little bit about planning with the state, and I know you're the vice chair of the State Workforce Investment Board. Tell us a little bit about that, what you're doing, and some of the great things that are happening.
Well, I'd be happy to, because it's not a well-known or universally known group, and it's a fairly new group. Under Governor LePage, he's restructured the old Maine Jobs Council. People might be more familiar with that, but in a nutshell, the state of Maine, like every state, receives federal dollars, millions of federal dollars every year to be applied to the retraining and upgrading of skills for Maine citizens who've lost their jobs or who want to get into a more challenging or lucrative position. So the federal government, through the Workforce Investment Act, sends these federal dollars into the various states. And the role of the State Workforce Investment Board is to oversee how those dollars get utilized and how they get spent in the state of Maine.
And so some of the challenges with divvying up that money or being able to use it in an effective way have been, and what are some of the things you're looking at to overcome those challenges?
Well, as an example, how much of that money should be spent on direct training versus supplying career center? We're blessed in the state of Maine to have some great career centers available in many of the communities across the state, and they do a great job of helping people post jobs, look for jobs, create a resume, you know, do all those kinds of things that help you find work, but that's not really hard training. You're bringing your skills with you, and there's an assistance in trying to apply those skills elsewhere and find a new job, but one of the challenges that we have, to your question, is trying to figure out how much is appropriate to be spent on those kinds of necessary services versus how much should actually be earmarked and targeted towards hardcore training. So as an example, let's just say we had a business that moved here from another state and was looking for welders and was having a difficult time finding welders. Some of those dollars can be used and should be used to help train people who are unemployed and have a proclivity for and an aptitude for being a welder. And if we, as a state, using those dollars, can supply that training, then it makes it much more likely that that business would relocate here because there's a trained workforce. So it's a challenge because you try to figure out how to divvy it up, how to use the dollars wisely because they're not unlimited, and there's always competition for those dollars. So the challenge is with anything, just like your household budget, how do I take what money we have and apply it in such a way that I meet most of the needs and prioritize correctly?
No, I think it's a critical piece of, you know, trying to look forward into the future of how we can grow any state, any place in the country. And those dollars, with everything going on in Washington, probably is going to be either cut or, you know, they may not be cut. It's just an unknown, correct, in terms of what will happen?
Well, you know, there's always there's always that unknown because nothing is forever. So I think one of the things that we can do as a board and as a state is to make sure that every dollar counts, that it's not spent frivolously, and that it's not spent on overhead when it could go directly to training. So, I mean, trying to make every dollar count because you never do know what's going to happen during tough budgetary times. And I think it makes a huge difference in the ability for the state to try to keep businesses here and attract businesses from other places. One of the things that we can't tell new business people who are looking at Maine is that we have, you know, lowest energy costs. We know we don't. Or that you're on the way to somewhere else. We're really not. We're kind of the end of the line before you hit Canada. You know, we can't tell them that it's a warm weather state, but we can tell them we have a great workforce and it's a well-trained workforce and that the state invests in that workforce and that that's a major component of your business. So that's what we're looking for. We're looking for that as a competitive advantage because you are competing. You're competing to keep the businesses you have and you're competing to attract new ones here.
No, it's very true, and I think that this is a critical piece of where you can see government and private industry come together to make sure that it's working in conjunction with each other to try to make things happen. You know, we had Jean Paquette on the show a few weeks ago, and she talked about how the state is looking to have and build a better partnership with the employers of the state, and I think this is, again, a key piece to what needs to be done to move forward here, not only in the state, but to move forward of getting the people that we need here in the right employment mix.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm personally a guy who has had one of his two kids move out of state in search of employment. And many, many parents in Maine have that same experience. And I think a dream for many parents would be to have their kids stay right here because they found the right job, the right employment, have a future here. So I think it's critical not just for those of us who are here and are here by choice, but for those who are coming behind us and who we want to stay here.
No, well, thank you very much, Kevin, for being on the show today. Great insight into the medical profession and some of the challenges that are going on, especially in the recruiting end. I appreciate the case studies and so forth. So I want to thank you very much for being on the show today.
Well, it's my pleasure, David. Thanks for having me.
And we'll be right back. Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour, and we're talking with Rich Brewer. He's the president and founder of OneWarriorOne.org. That's O-N-E, Warrior, W-O-N, HRPowerHour.org. Rich, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me on, Dave.
No, that's great. And now, you're a national speaker. You've been on Fox, CNN. You've been to the big times, and thank you for coming on Little Old HR Power Hour.
Oh, no, as Ray would remind me, this is the big time.
No, that's right, so. It is. Now, we're excited. We're streaming in across the country, and we've had hits on the website for over 36 states, so we're very excited about it.
Outstanding. I look forward to being heard.
Great. So, you know, one of the things that we talk a lot about is hiring individuals or hiring people in the HR world, and looking at businesses, hiring individuals, and a lot of people coming back from, you know, service to the country. And I do want to do a shout out quick to my dad, who sometimes listens to this show, and he's a World War II Marine.
I give him a oorah.
That's what he'll we like it. To hear, and he's great. And but, you know, they're coming back from, you know, the service, and it's a challenge sometimes to get back in the workforce. And employers sometimes wonder, you know, what can they do for us? So talk to us a little bit about hiring vets.
It's an interesting and complex issue. A recent study by the New American Security Institute stated that 30% of their companies that they polled hire vets because it was the right thing to do. You know, that was just a good patriotic thing to do. And then 70% said they hire strictly based upon bottom line. And although veterans have interesting resumes, integrity, maturity, discipline, teamwork, leadership skills, that sort of thing, trying to translate that into what can you do for my company was one of the major concerns that these companies had. So by a large part, a majority of the companies polled liked veterans. They liked the what I call almost unteachable attributes that they have. Because I remember a few years ago, businesses were talking about how it was hard to find people with good character and moral integrity and, you know, that give back and that sort of thing.
Sure.
So now we have a plethora of that, and companies are now looking for specific skill sets. So the biggest challenge, I think, transitioning back from military to the civilian world is how do we translate military skill sets into civilian job sets? And there's been a number of websites up. H2H.jobs is one of them, where both employers and potential employees can go. And you type in your MOS, your military occupation specialty, and it comes up with a translation of words that you may not have thought of to put on your resume. And it allows an employer to kind of look at that and translate that into, you know, a possible skill set they could use in their company.
I think that's important because certainly when you're talking about resume writing and you're talking about employers, whether it be HR professionals or owners looking at resumes, resumes are that first moment that you get to look about and about the person, and it talks to who that person is. And so words matter, right? I mean, words matter in terms of understanding what they can bring to the organization, because you got to get past that hurdle to then get seen.
It's usually that cover letter.
That's right.
You know, and it's a short, succinct cover letter. And most veterans don't have a problem impressing somebody on a cover letter. Hey, I mean, let's face it. Look at what they've done for this country. That's impressive. So once they get past that, then it's a matter of the companies deciding, do they have a skill set that we can use somehow, besides those intangibles of leadership and all that. And another thing is how much of a risk is an HR person or a company willing to take on a person? Let's say they have all those, you know, intangible assets of leadership and discipline and integrity and mission-driven, all that sort of stuff. And are they willing to say, okay, you know, let's take that person and let's do some OJT? They may not have the specific skill sets we need, but I bet you they're a quick learner, just based upon the fact that they can think on their feet, because that's what they've done in combat, and so that they can probably come in and learn fairly quickly. So, you know, I think it depends on how much a company's willing to risk on hiring a veteran as far as on-the-job training goes.
Well, you know, certainly with the economy it is today, you know, companies have limited training dollars. They want somebody, and the main reason skills are back is they want somebody who can hit the ground running, right? So you can just, bang, get going, know what they're doing already, and then you have the intangible, that fit. You know, can they fit to the culture? Can they fit to the organization? Can they not do damage? damage to my organization and come in and be, you know, someone who's an outsider and not congeal with everybody else and make it happen. So it is that challenge of if they're going to take the time to train somebody on something that they may not be fully up to speed on.
Exactly. And, you know, there's organizations out there. One of them is MOST, which is Mobile Outreach Skills Training. And it's actually the brainchild of, we all remember the show Cheers. Yeah. And I can't remember the mailman, Ratzenberger, John Ratzenberger. Mm-hmm. And he went on, and one of his shows was Made in America. He traveled for,
right.
I think, maybe
I
USA Network
actually,
or something
yes.
like that.
Yes.
So what he's done now is he's retrofitted these buses and semi-trailers and that sort of stuff. And he literally would go and park. An example was Smith & Wesson in Springfield, Massachusetts. Now, they needed a certain number of people who could lathe with a certain skill set, welders, that sort of thing. They contacted MOST. He comes in and literally sets up these shops in the parking lot, brings in veterans who have already been pre-screened by Smith & Wesson, and he provides the training that they need for Smith & Wesson. So they get trained by MOST, and then they walk out of that trailer or that bus in the parking lot right back into the job of Smith & Wesson, now a trained individual.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, that's certainly a way to assist employers who are challenged in the training area on time.
And money.
And money, absolutely. And that's a key area to make sure that they are able to help and bring this person in and give them a job and get them ready to go.
It is. And again, I think there's a number of different hurdles that these people will face. And one of the biggest ones of that 70% that I talked about earlier, the company executives talked about stigma as well. The stigma of hiring a vet. And I, you know, I've heard this obviously numerous times about hiring a vet who may or may not have PTSD and, you know, what's that going to look like in the workplace? And, you know, there's that stigma that's been personified by the media, Hollywood, of these people, quote unquote, you know, going off, if you will, ticking time bombs, that sort of thing. And when you ask these employers, potential employers anyway, you know, how many people on your staff are currently manic depressive? How many people suffer from chronic insomnia? I mean, they don't have a clue, yet they want to prejudge somebody, a veteran who I think has already proven themselves worthy of a job within a company. They want to prejudge based solely on a stigma. I was talking to a general recently down in Dallas who's on a job initiative there, and he goes around and talks to these company CEOs, IBM and everybody, and you know, publicly they're all given the lip service of, yes, let's hire these vets. We're going to hire 250,000 vets by the end of 2014. Let's do this. And then afterwards in the back room, you know, they'll say to the general, we're a little worried about the PTSD aspect of things. And that's basically born out of ignorance and lack of education around just what that is. So, you know, it's a hurdle, but it's one that can be easily overcome with some educational training for company executives, for HR people. They have to be educated about this new group of people that they now have available. You know, we haven't had this large number of veterans, 2.8 million, available to corporations and companies since World War II.
No, and I think the other part of it is interesting because, you know, we've had discussions with employers who have talked about the fact that it's not just men coming back now. It's also women who serve, and there is a different perception maybe of one or the other in terms of the hiring process. And that's an area that is, you know, something that has to be looked at.
Yeah, well, currently right now, the unemployment rate for a male coming back, post-9/11 male, I think the average unemployment rate's just a bit above 10%, which is a little above national average. Now, for a woman returning back, that's 21%. Unemployment rate for a woman returning from combat. The perception is that the men are the warriors, and so that the women vets, who are often side by side with their male counterparts, especially in the Muslim countries where women can't be searched by males, so they actually form these teams of women who are out on patrol with their male counterparts, helping in and assisting in searches of homes, searches of people, that sort of thing. And they're coming back, and they don't have that warrior status. And this is the time to change that perception, simply because the lines are so blurred about women's role in combat and not in combat. There's no front lines anymore.
Right.
Right. You know?
No,
so even support personnel are literally frontline
right.
personnel.
Right. You're not just lining up and firing at opposite times.
Exactly.
You know, this is not the way it is anymore. You know, so now you've gone through, you've made the decision to potentially hire a veteran. You've understood, maybe you've been educated, and you say, okay, I want to bring some on board. So what now? What's the next part of that process? You've brought them in. You know, tell me your thoughts on that.
Well, I think that, you know, hiring a vet, again, is your best bet. And that's one of those catchphrases that the VA uses all the time, the famous for great PR catchphrases. But, you know, so you hire a vet. Now, what are you going to do to get the most out of that veteran skill set besides what they bring to the job, technically, if you will? And a lot of that is going to depend on how well you understand veterans and veterans' issues. You know, if you're a cubicle office, let's say, where you've got a bunch of cubicles and that's the way your layout is, you know, if you have a veteran and you put them, him or her, in a middle cubby in the middle of the room with 8-foot, you know, basic cubby walls, if you will, that's going to make them uncomfortable. And chances are they're not going to say anything because they're the new hire, right? So they're not going to make any complaints or anything. So they're going to be in the middle of this room, unable to see unless they stand up to see. And for somebody who's been in a combat theater, taking away their visual surveillance ability, if you will, is really going to decline their productivity. So you want to take something like that into account. And again, education from someone like myself, speaking to companies, HR people, floor level supervisors and managers, saying, okay, well, let's make sure that that veteran has outside cubicle, so that they don't have to worry about being surrounded and not being able to see. Used to be in the day and age when everyone had a copying room, and that's where the copiers were. But now you have one printer that feeds 20 computers, and it could be located anywhere. Now, if it's located next to this veteran's desk, and it starts to go off whenever it wants to, although the veteran never pressed print because somebody 3 cubicles away did, that's going to startle them. Now, we can call that PTSD if you want, but it's not PTSD in its sense of disruption, but it's going to disrupt that veteran momentarily and take away some of his or her productivity. So there's these little nuances you can do. You know, depending on how big your company is, are there other veterans that you've hired from previous conflicts or peacetime? And can you get some sort of veteran support group going within your own company? Because we are a unique subset, especially combat veterans. You know, we speak a different language. And you know this, if your father's a Marine from World War II, you know, we have that lingo. So, you know, if there's other veterans who are in your company and been there for a while, why not mentor up? Give them a mentor, you know? And I think those little things that are really, there's no cost associated to it, will allow you to get the most out of the veteran you're hiring.
What I liked about what you're talking about is simple, basic, in some sense, common sense steps that you can take to make your office, to make your employment environment really conducive to high productivity, and using the integrity, the work ethic that comes from someone who's a veteran, and really maximizing that potential. That's what we're talking about, right? About maximizing it. And in reality, it's really no different than when you have an employee that has a challenge. And, you know, you're going to try to make their environment the best it can be so that you can get the most out of them.
And they're usually the most grateful and will work hardest for you. Now, conversely on that, and you brought that up, is, you know, these guys are coming from the military. We work basically from sunup to sundown and then usually right through the night as well. So we come into the civilian world. And, you know, we hit the clock at 7, we punch in, whatever it is, you know, and at 9 o'clock is the coffee break, or at 10 o'clock. These guys and girls aren't used to this. So they're much more apt to just stay at their desk, you know, especially if there's a deadline, depending on what the company's doing or whatever. And these guys, you know, they're just going to push through things, get it done. They are focused on mission and mission accomplishment. And one of the issues that has been brought up is the issue of making other workers look less productive. And so, again, with some education, HR and managers need to be made aware of that so that they can make sure that personality conflicts that may arise are truly personality conflicts and not a conflict about the fact that the new hire is making other people look bad based upon the productivity. When I was first hired on as a state trooper in Massachusetts, a young rookie, I went down to an unnamed barracks because I'm not going to name names, but I was young, on fire, ready to get going. You know, as a combat veteran, you know, I'm going to save the world. Now I'm going to save the state of Massachusetts from every criminal out there. You know, I get out there, I'm ready to rock and roll. I had a 19-year veteran of the state police take my keys one time at the start of my shift, and he said, sit down. Read a book, do something, but you'll get your keys back when I'm ready. And I was like, what are you doing? He says, you're making the rest of us look bad. You know, you're out there writing tickets. You're giving, you know, 20, 30 tickets of this. Your inspection stickers, speeding, all this good stuff. That makes the rest of us look bad. So you sit there until I give you your keys back. And, you know, as a brand new trooper, I was okay. You know what I mean? So, I mean, I think I think, again, the educational component that HR and the supervisory staff need around this issue is really what's going to help with the retention factor. Because if not, the veterans are going to just get frustrated with their fellow employees and say, this isn't a fit for me.
No,
I need to be somewhere where people are going to work, they're going to get the job done on time, and move on.
And you're listening to the HR Power Hour. We're talking to Rich Brewer. Rich, again, thank you for being on the show today. You know, we're talking about veterans and hiring vets. So now that we have them on board, we've made some of the accommodations necessary to ensure that they are productive. We've done all the paperwork. We've trained the managers. We got everybody going, and the process is moving forward. So we want to retain them now. How do we do that?
I think as long as you've taken the steps that you just spoke of, that you've made minor adjustments, and those are the ones we spoke about in the earlier segment, that you've really taken the time to bring in somebody and educate your HR and your management staff about veterans in general. And again, not the needs or anything that you need to do, but just items that you basically should be aware of when you're hiring veterans. And then after that, I think the retention, if you create that type of atmosphere that you actually care enough to make these accommodations, to bring in somebody to speak to the senior staff, if you will, on behalf of veterans. Because again, veterans, as being a new hire, aren't going to speak up too much. And veterans in general will just shut up, put up, and move on. Because that's the military mentality, is do more with little and don't complain about it.
Right.
So they'll sit there and be miserable and keep moving on and doing what they do, or they'll quit. And I think if a company creates an atmosphere that we value you, it only spreads to the other employees as well. Again, you'd mentioned it earlier. It's common sense. But we're dealing with a subset of culture here of veterans. So you say, hey, this is what we're going to do to make sure we retain veterans, whether it's a mentoring program, whether it's making sure your desk placement is where you're most productive, that sort of thing. But we're also going to make sure that we have a healthy, happy, if you will, employee atmosphere to come into every day. So the retention process is, you know, what is the ongoing training? If a veteran does need time to go to the VA because they have an appointment at the VA to take care of stuff, many veterans, that's their health care, or if they're filing a disability claim or something like that. As a supervisor, you have to understand that they have no control over when appointments are made, how long appointments are. You have to remember that if you're here in the state of Maine, it's all the way in Augusta that they have to go to. And in many other parts of the country, when you're filing a disability claim, you can't go to one of the outlet centers that they have, like here in Portland or something. They have to go to the main hospital in order to have that done. And they have no control over that. Believe me, we wish we did. And then once there, it's the old military adage of standby to standby, hurry up and wait. So be sympathetic to that. Believe me, they'd much rather be working than sitting there filing a disability claim at the VA or sitting in the doctor's office or something like that. So know that they don't always have control over those sort of things.
No, that's good information, because I'm not sure employers know that. I'm not sure the employers understand that that's part of the process. You know, they may know that, hey, you made a doctor's appointment, and why would you schedule it for that time, not knowing that they had absolutely no idea that
exactly.
They couldn't have scheduled it for any other time.
And from my own experience, they basically send you a letter with the date and time on it, And if you cannot make that, you call them back, and you can reschedule. But again, the appointment will probably be 2 to 3 more months out. So most guys don't want to do that. Most girls don't want to do that. So I think it's important. And again, it's one of these things that the employers learn by bringing in somebody like myself who has that knowledge that can make these things run a little smoother when, you know, hiring a vet and then retaining the vet and, you know, making it as positive experience as possible.
You talked a lot about doing seminars for leadership and doing seminars for senior members of the management. Is there ever a time that there should be a seminar for the whole team itself so that they understand?
Without a doubt. I think that once the leadership is on board, and I believe the leadership does indeed need to be on board, once that happens, then I think it's imperative that we bring in the, you know, the coworkers as well. But we have to walk a fine line here. Veterans don't want to be treated as, you know, we're different people. That's not the case, nor do we want to be looked at as different. So when you talk about going down to the coworker level, what I would work on, if it was me giving the talk, is team building. Not so much, here's Johnny, he's the new hire and he's the vet, so we all want to be sympathetic to Johnny's needs. That's not how you want to go about it. You know, if he's a part of a team or however your company's broken down, that's when you want to start talking about team building and that sort of stuff. And again, I think that can only benefit your entire company and all your employees.
No, I agree 100%, and that makes a big difference in an organization that's willing to spend on team building and driving communication between everybody in the organization. You know, one of the things we haven't yet talked about is some of the things that are out there in terms of the GI Bill and other, you know, financial assistance programs or employment assistance programs for employers or vets that can help match the two together. So talk to us a little bit about those.
Well, on the local level here in Maine, we've got the Portland Veterans Network right here through the Portland Chamber of Commerce that is accessible to all post-9/11 veterans. If you go onto the State of Maine website, they have the hire a vet process there. Of course, the VA has a federal link. JoiningForces.com is the White House initiative that kind of is a one resource. That's what it's meant to be. It's still kind of getting that way, but it's meant to be as kind of a one resource area. Of course, we had the tax incentives for hiring veterans that's out there. But so we have the GI Bill, which is the best we've had since World War II. So we have a lot of these guys coming out going back to college. The unfortunate part right now is that the graduation rate is between 6% and 9%. And again, it's because of that transition. Transitioning from military life to college life, I remember I got out of the Corps on a Friday, and on Monday morning I was sitting in a sociology class, and it was night and day.
Yeah, I can't imagine a more different contrast than
exactly
those two environments.
Well, I'll give you one more. Combat veteran to classroom instead of just a veteran to classroom. Mm-hmm. That's even a much more startling difference, if you will. And so I think there needs to be a lot of work done on a college campus area to help retain veterans there as well. And again, if we're going to be training these people for jobs for the future and that sort of thing, then we must get better at retaining them on a college point in order to get them to the point where they do have the degrees that many of the HR people are looking for. On the other hand, the VA has a Volk Rehab program. So if you have 15% service-connected disability or more, you are able to go to the VA, and they have a vocational rehabilitation program where they will pay for any and all schooling that you need to be trained for an area at need, whether it's welding, mechanic, full-fledged college degrees, whatever area you may find yourself wanting, that's out there and available as well. Now, a lot of it has, especially when we talk about the government, there's red tape attached to it. I just was reading some articles about the VA being a little slow on paying schools and paying the veterans and that sort of thing. And again, I think that we, the American government, have been slow at being ready for this. And now it's beginning to be here. We're out of Iraq. We're drawing down out of Afghanistan. And we're not ready for it. So we're still playing catch up. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. When these veterans are full force coming, and we're downsizing our military at the same time, we will have literally hundreds of thousands of veterans hitting the civilian world looking for jobs, looking to go to college, and unfortunately, I believe, spiking the unemployment rate for veterans because we're playing catch up with it.
Sure. No, it's really a big concern in terms of the employment of great people who have done a great service to the country. And it's important to be able to bring them back into the workforce, to bring them into real life, if you want to say, from our perspective in terms of day-to-day activities. So what got you into this? I mean, you've started OneWarrior1.org, and that's O-N-E, Warrior, W-O-N.org. I want to spell it out.
That's right.
Year. So what got you into this? What got you started, and why do you do it?
Well, I'm a combat veteran from the Beirut area from the 1980s. I'm a Purple Heart recipient as well. I know what it is to fight and bleed on behalf of this country. I'm also a 28-year sufferer of PTSD, along with a myriad of other physical injuries. And 3 years ago, it almost all came to an end when I decided that it just wasn't worth fighting anymore. My facade looked wonderful. You know, I had that house in Falmouth. I had two kids and a dog and a cat and a loving wife and two cars, blah, blah, blah. But inside, it was hell. I'd been reliving that war, reliving the friends I lost, survival guilt, da, 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 da. And I just wanted to end it all and just stop with the fakeness. And I almost did that. And obviously, since I'm here talking to you, I didn't. But I did profess on that point in time to do something so that others didn't reach this point. We have 18 veteran suicides a day, over 6,000 a year. 40 a day attempted. We're getting towards two active duty soldiers a day killing themselves. So I think part of it is that I have a personal mission. I've often wondered why I survived when many of my friends died. 3 years ago, I think that crystallized for me. I was meant to do what I'm doing. So this is a personal passion for me. I have this knowledge. I've enhanced my knowledge of it by studying like crazy for the last 3 years about PTSD. And now I want to make sure that other veterans don't have to lose decades of their life trying to transition back into society.
Well, this is a great program, a great service that you do to the country. Thank you for your service overall. And thank you to all the vets listening for their service. And, you know, we want to make sure that this information gets out there. So obviously everybody can go to the HRPowerHour.com and they'll be able to download the link and get your information. It'll go directly to your site and so forth so they can get this information. We encourage employers and HR professionals to look at that and hire a vet. It's your best bet will be the quote. I wrote that down. That's a good one. But I want to thank you very much today for being on the show and appreciate your time.
Well, thank you for having me.
And now your HR tip of the week. The questions most often asked by business consultants is, how can we motivate employees? The answer is, you can't. The problem is with the question. It implies that somewhere there are gimmicks, strategies, or techniques that once discovered and implemented will double or even triple employee motivation and resulting productivity. Motivation that lasts is not something management does, but rather a process that management fosters and allows to happen. And that's your tip of the week. Next week on the HR Power Hour, we're going to be speaking with Ann Rhodes from Albuquerque, New Mexico. She is the founder of People Inc. and the author of the best-selling book Built on Values. Ann helps organizations create people-centric cultures. Catch us every week at 2 p.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.